Welcome back to another episode of Sea Control Asia Pacific, a podcast series brought to you by the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Natalie Sambi, your host, and today my guest is Nadia Balkan, a senior associate at the Asia Group in Washington, D.C. We delve deeply into Indonesia's history of violence and horror stories. Nadia explains to us the various permutations of Indonesian nationalism and their ramifications for Indonesia's foreign policy and its strategic outlook. We talk a little bit about the Indonesia-China confrontation in the South China Sea, but we talk about the impact of unresolved political and ethnic struggle in the country and the way that impacts its outlook and its sense of identity. Lastly, we talk a little bit about Nadia's passion for fiction writing and the way she explored Indonesia through her horror stories before providing some film picks for our listeners who are curious to learn more about the country. But before we get into that, we'll be back after this short break.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSEC is and always will be free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There's a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSEC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And welcome back, listeners. As mentioned in the intro, I'm here with my friend Nadia Balkan to talk a little bit about Indonesia. Nadia, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Natalie.
As always, we like to kick off with a little bit about our guests. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you find yourself working on Indonesia?
Thanks. Well, I was raised in Jakarta up until 1998. My dad was Indonesian and my mom is American, so kind of like Barack Obama. To be honest, a large part of the reason I started focusing on Indonesia in college and graduate school was to better understand modern Indonesian history. All I knew was what I'd learned from Suharto-era textbooks, which, needless to say, required some clarification, or a lot of clarification.
And we should just clarify that Suharto was the military dictator from the late 60s till the late 90s, and things were a little bit tight under control in his era, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It was a very interesting time to be a kid. What I understood about elections was that was the day that we always got school off, because there was always going to be protests and riots in the streets. I had no sense that there was any possibility that anyone other than Suharto would ever be president, until, of course, it happened in Reformasi in 1998. So that was sort of the Indonesia that I grew up with. And I think as I got older, it was important to me to sort of look back on a lot of the things that, you know, basically my teachers had taught me, and say, you know, was this reality or was this, you know, maybe not quite so much reality? And a lot of the time, I hate to say it, but, you know, I would say 60 to 70% of what I learned was not entirely the truth. So that was a large part of why I personally really became interested in doing research in Indonesia.
And then you went on afterwards, you did your undergraduate?
Yes. So I did my undergraduate at Barnard College, where I, you know, strive to find classes that would let me study Indonesia. That was a little difficult, to be honest. And I actually took the opportunity when I had it to go study abroad in Melbourne, because I knew that there was going to be more focus on Indonesia there. And I had a great experience at the University of Melbourne. I studied with Kate McGregor, who's you know, sort of spend a lot of her academic focus on studying the 1965 anti-communist killings in Indonesia. So that was a really great experience just to have the opportunity to learn from her and to do my own research on the subject. Eventually I went to graduate school in Washington, D.C., and ever since then I've been focused much more particularly on Indonesia and in particular on nationalism and studying the interesting phenomenon that is Indonesian nationalism.
Yes, it's been a very different kind of nationalism since the end of the military dictatorship. I just wanted to talk a little bit. You talked about growing up in Jakarta. What was the Indonesia like, besides the information control and the expectation that, you know, Suharto would become the president at every election? What else was Indonesia or Jakarta like when you were a kid?
Compared to now?
Yeah.
Honestly, it wasn't all that different, you know? I mean, now I think when I go back, it's a lot more crowded. There's just, the infrastructure hasn't grown to keep up with the amount of people that have come to Jakarta. I think that another sort of noteworthy thing is when I was a kid, I think Islam played a much less sort of public role in everyday life. Everybody was sort of acknowledged to be Muslim, but, you know, you didn't see women wearing hijab all the time. And now I think that's significantly, I think, changed. So that's just, you know, a couple things. But honestly, like, the Indonesian spirit is the Indonesian spirit, and I haven't noticed a major change. Most of those, you know, the changes were, I think, political. And, of course, you know, if you look at sort of the ethnic issues and stuff, I think that the experience for, you know, Chinese Indonesians is continuing to evolve in a more positive direction, I hope, just in terms of, you know, when I was a kid, there were no Chinese signs, there were no Chinese names, and now that appears to be much more liberalized.
That's interesting. I mean, when you talked about the Indonesian spirit, the way I feel about that is, I think, you know, Indonesians are sort of fiercely proud of the fact that they fought against external powers, they fought back against the Dutch in order to gain their independence, and they've kept themselves together, and they are, you know, the bearers of a long and rich history that included Hindu and Buddhist empires and you know, all of that kind of stuff. How do you see the Indonesia spirit?
So I think you're absolutely right, and I think that is a large part of why the Indonesian spirit has remained strong, sort of in spite of not an easy 21st century and 20th century. I think that the Indonesian spirit also involves sort of this attitude of, like, I can take whatever life throws at me. Unfortunately, that sometimes means, I think, you know, I can take 300 years of colonialism. I don't necessarily have to do something right now in order to fix things. It's kind of like, you know, c'est la vie. There's that kind of attitude, I think. And I think that has made Indonesia very, like, just able to withstand a lot of crises, a lot of change. But on the other hand, maybe, it, you know, it breeds a kind of complacence, is what I would say. And a kind of feeling like it'll work itself out. Without my necessarily having to pitch in and make a big plan and a strategy about it right now. And I think that you can kind of see some of that in Indonesian policy making.
Is there any particular thing that comes to mind when you're thinking of that?
Honestly, South China Sea is a little bit of this, in my opinion. I think there's a little bit of sense of, like, if we don't rock the boat, we can somehow get through this, it'll work itself out, and maybe it's better to just not cause more problems right now rather than, you know, be seen as a troublemaker.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, Indonesia's got that kind of, like, we're going to just stay on the sidelines, we're going to be an honest broker. That's the, you know, the terminology that they've used. Uh-huh. They're not a direct claimant to any of the disputes. They have an overlapping area around the Riau province in the north, which overlaps with the Nine-Dash Line, and they've continually asked China to clarify that. But until such a stage, like you said, they were just kind of like, we're going to wait this out.
Yeah, yeah. That's what it seems like to me, anyway. And I think that, you know, the million-dollar question now is, like, what happens now that the Natuna incident with China recently, you know, they made it very public. You know, they were very forward on that, much surprisingly so for Indonesia. I think that we're all sort of waiting to see how exactly Indonesia responds to Natuna.
Definitely.
And Yeah.
And just
think,
to give some of the listeners,
either way.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to give some of the listeners some context, on March 19th, there was a confrontation between Indonesian maritime authorities. They had seized a Chinese fishing boat, illegally poaching in Indonesian waters, arrested the crew, and were attempting to tow the boat back. And I believe that they were actually in territorial waters. I hope
yes.
so. Or if not, in territorial
they
waters.
They were in the EEZ.
They were
least,
in the EEZ,
yeah.
Okay. But I think the boat was caught in the territorial waters. And then a Chinese Coast Guard vessel attempted to disengage the Chinese fishing boat from the Indonesian authorities. They had confronted them and then successfully recaptured the boat and took it away. But the Indonesians were furious. You know, the Maritime Affairs Minister, you know, was absolutely livid. The Foreign Minister was livid, summoned the Chinese ambassador to, you know, Kemlu to discuss what was going on, to explain. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said, no, they were fishing in Chinese traditional waters, so there's a disjoint there between, you know, who has what and who owns what. But you're right, this was the first time it was so public. I mean,
yeah.
Do you think this is actually, do you think Indonesia is going to have to revisit its position of being an honest broker as a result of this, or where can it go from here?
Well, I think it doesn't necessarily have to mean that they won't be an honest broker if they become more assertive on South China Sea issues. I mean, I think that one option for Indonesia is to choose to be more supportive of its, you know, fellow ASEAN states, you know, such as Philippines and Vietnam, including by supporting their diplomatic and legal, you know, political measures to try to kind of, you know, protect their maritime security and their maritime sovereignty. The other option, I think, is Indonesia just reacts by blowing up boats, chasing boats. You know, I mean, they also had an incident with a Taiwanese fishing vessel, for instance, recently, that was like, okay, I mean, this, we may be sort of overplaying and overreacting a little bit. And I think that one of, like, the former option that I laid out is kind of the Indonesia chooses to become a partner with its neighbors. And then the latter option is Indonesia is just looking at its own national sovereignty and not necessarily playing, I would say, a constructive role in helping to safeguard sort of the region's security. So I think whichever one they decide to go down, it's going to really say a lot about how this government in Jakarta is viewing Indonesia's role in the world.
See, that's really interesting because the blowing the boats policy, so, you know, illegal fishing vessels caught in Indonesia, the Jokowi administration said will be destroyed. And, you know, we've seen that since December, about 150 boats, I think, have been destroyed since then. Is this about nationalism? And if it is, how do you characterize the nationalism under the current administration? Is it any different to the previous administration, or is it marked, you know, in any kind of way?
Yeah, I think it absolutely is about nationalism. I mean, I think if you look at sort of Indonesian nationalism as a whole, you see a very close link between nationalist feeling and territory, sovereignty, land and water. You know, these are like the basic things that they see as defining Indonesia. And, you know, that's the main reason why, for instance, they were so reluctant to let go of East Timor, because that was part of the original Indonesia. And I think similar feelings will come up here with Natuna. So in regards to your question about what nationalism looks like today, I think that there are strains that you see today that have always been present. And I think, you know, this is one. But I do think that obviously this administration is different in how it's expressing it compared to Yudhoyono's administration, which was much more sort of internationalist, sort of the thousand friends, zero enemies, that stance, and really projecting that outward. Whereas this is a nationalism that is much more inward-looking, much more about protecting citizens, protecting resources, I would say. But again, you know, there's nothing really, I would say, that's particularly new. It's just in how it's expressed and sort of who's expressing it is maybe how I would put it.
That's interesting. I think you and I have had this discussion when we met in Washington about the Indonesian military. And what I noticed is that the last couple of chief of defense forces have been much more vocal about talking about protecting Indonesian sovereignty. And, you know, as you said, there's that latent sensitivity about interference, about territoriality and the loss of sovereignty over things like Timor. So General Numantio, the current Chief of Defense Force, has been talking about proxy wars and saying that, you know, Western countries just want to weaken Indonesia, and they're doing it by drugs and stealing our resources, and homosexuality is a blight in Indonesian society designed to be disruptive. What are your thoughts on this? Where is this coming from?
Well, you know, I think that sort of rhetoric has, you know, like I said, has been a part of what is now sort of the right-leaning Indonesian nationalism, if I may put it that way. Ironically, I think it's actually a descendant of Sukarno's, the first president, his sort of left-leaning nationalism that was very much focused on anti-imperialism and, you know, also national sovereignty. But you can see how over the years this, you know, very deeply compelling nationalist narrative has become influenced by more conservative elements. And I think that's especially true in the military and other more conservative organizations. And you can see similar language among, you know, some of the religious groups and even some of the political parties. That's not that I don't think there's no element of political posturing. I think there is. But I also think, you know, it's important to realize that this is just tapping into some of these, like, really old nationalist themes. And, you know, I also want to say that that's not to say that this is the end-all and be-all of Indonesian nationalism.
Sure. And you talked a little bit about, you know, the first forms of nationalism around Sukarno being anti-imperialist and also, I suppose, anti-colonialist.
Yes.
And I don't think we talk enough about Indonesia's colonial experience and then what kind of impact that kind of has on the nation's psychology. I remember reading one of your blog posts, and for listeners, I'll provide the URL for Nadia's blog later, which has some great things. I'm going to quote from you. You said, "Colonialism is one of those historical sins that keeps on giving, resurrecting, no matter how fast you try to run from it. Sometimes the faster you run, the faster it catches up." It struck me, and I had to ask, like, what does that mean to you? And does that apply to Indonesia?
Yeah, I was actually thinking of Indonesia when I wrote that. So it absolutely does apply, in my opinion. And, you know, I think the direct correlation, I would say, is what happened with guided democracy under Sukarno. But I think just to expand a little more, I think it's fascinating how colonialism has this tendency to spawn these really idealistic, sort of charismatic post-colonial leaders who nonetheless kind of end up abiding by a lot of the same totalitarian principles as, you know, the former imperial overlord. I think it probably stems in large part from the fact that you learn what it means to be a legitimate leader of your country from colonists. I think that has to do, that, you know, that's got to be like a really influential part of it. I think a lot of post-colonial leaders are trying very hard to lift their country out of poverty, you know, to win respect on the international stage, to keep their populations safe from instability and possible civil war. And a lot of times the quickest way to achieve these goals, you know, ironically, involves centralizing power, silencing the opposition, and generally absorbing resources from the periphery and devoting them to the engine of the state, which is pretty much proto-fascism, right?
Right.
So suddenly you're being accused of essentially colonizing your own people. And that is absolutely an accusation that Indonesia is still dealing with, you know, especially in terms of its approach to Papua, for instance. And I think it's trying to undo this, but it's been a long road. And I think that, yeah, I mean, for instance, you know, my uncle works in Indonesia, he's Indonesian, and this is the issue that he actually works on is development in Papua. And one of the things that he was, you know, telling me last time I was there was how they wanted to send him out to Papua to live there and to sort of oversee the processes that the Indonesian federal government wanted to implement. And he was like, "This is a bad idea. I'm Javanese. They're just going to see me as basically a colonist." And just to see that dynamic repeat 60, 70 years after independence is really remarkable, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think for you and I mean, we think Indonesia, the word Indonesia and the nation of Indonesia is one thing, but for people who live there, which island you're from, which ethnic group that you come from is extremely important as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, it's not something that I even, you know, feel confident sort of speaking too much for, because, you know, my family, the side of my family that is Indonesian, is Javanese. In terms of the totem pole within Indonesia, like, we're the group that's on top. We're the group that has always been, you know, has always had control of Indonesia, essentially. And it's important to realize that, Matt, I know that's, you know, part of your heritage, too, is that this is something that has been a very contentious issue in the past, you know, 60 years of Indonesia's existence.
Of course. It's really interesting, because we had another podcast yesterday in my day job with Brian Kraft, who I think, you know, has worked on Indonesia issues in Washington as well. And he talked about the possibility, the current Jakarta governor, who is an ethnic Chinese Indonesian and a Christian, possibly making a run for the presidency. Now, as you alluded to earlier, you know, race relations in Indonesia are something that maybe not a lot of people outside of the country really understand, and that the Chinese Indonesians for a long time had to integrate. And so having any kind of prominent role in Indonesian society is something that is not common. What do you think? Is there a chance? Is Indonesia ready to see a Chinese Indonesian Christian president?
Oh, man.
I mean, I don't mean to laugh because it's just in the next election cycle. Well, I mean, maybe not.
I think Indonesia is ready for maybe a very prominent role for Ahok, who's the guy you're talking about. You know, I mean, I think it's remarkable how popular he is among Jakartans. But of course, remember, I mean, it's Jakarta. Like, it's, if you, you know, you're going to get sort of like the progressives in Jakarta, right? But it's still remarkable that he's, how popular he is and how much people support his policies. It's really wonderful. However, I think once you get into the national political scene, you need to start having to deal with the political parties. I think that it might take a few more election cycles before we're there, to be honest.
No, I completely agree. I just, like, your reaction, which was like, oh boy. I think really speaks to some of the challenges still that I don't think are appreciated within Indonesian politics and in society as well. And we could talk about this for days. We could talk about some of the ethnic issues and all those kinds of things as well. But I think the important point, I think, for us to note is that these things are still going on. Indonesia is still contending with these kinds of things, as every country is within their political system. But these things are Indonesia's baggage, I suppose.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, for better or for worse. And it makes it what it is today. So, I mean, Indonesia, apart from moving from these kinds of issues, and you talked about infrastructure, you also talked about the possibility about it taking more of a diplomatic role when it comes to playing a role in Southeast Asia with regards to security. What would it take for it to play that kind of role?
I think that the leaders need to decide to take that role. I think right now the president and, you know, the foreign ministry have not yet decided that they want to take that role. But I think that absolutely in the past, Indonesia has led ASEAN and has been a very positive voice within ASEAN. I think that the reality is right now, the president is more focused on internal issues. And honestly, I don't begrudge him that. There are a lot of internal issues that need to be focused on. But, you know, it's also true that Indonesia shouldn't be silent, I would say, in Southeast Asia, in the Asia Pacific, you know, in the world. Frankly, I mean, it's got so much of a stake in the world, considering its humongous population. Absolutely, its voice needs to be heard. So I do hope that the leaders decide that it is worthwhile to devote the sort of necessary personnel and time and energy resources to getting that done. I think that the recent, like the ongoing exercises that Indonesia is hosting right now, the Komodo exercise, you know, what President Jokowi said when he opened the exercise was basically that Indonesia's war is for humanity, on humanity's behalf. And, you know, I mean, that's great. I think that absolutely focusing on HADR, on counter-piracy, counter-terrorism, search and rescue, these are the things that Indonesia absolutely needs to work with its neighbors on and try to create more, more systematic regional cooperation mechanisms. You know, I think that MH370 really brought that home, frankly.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so it doesn't need to be, it doesn't need to take on something that's too confrontational, but I think that just creating systems through which it can more regularly share information and intelligence with its partners, especially in the region, and especially on issues that are sort of softer issues, is absolutely something that it should invest in when it feels like it can.
No, absolutely, and that's a really interesting thing when you say that Jokowi talks about the war on humanity. You know, he being a much more grassroots-oriented politician,
uh-huh.
certainly, you know, this is starting to kind of come down to a sense of, like, supporting human rights and supporting, you know, basic needs and things like that and being constructive and peaceful. That's not a legacy that Indonesia had. That's not something that it could have done, let's say, for instance, in the Suharto era.
Absolutely not.
Human rights a bit of a problem during that time. So it's really interesting now that having emerged from that military authoritarianism to a democratic character, the impact that's had not only on the kinds of things that Indonesia can pursue and promote, but the rhetoric that they can use.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think honestly, under the former president Yudo Yono, that was much more clear and vocal. How much Indonesia was sticking up for democracy and human rights in ASEAN, for instance, was I think something that was really welcomed. But, you know, I think I don't think that's gone. I don't think that's gone at all. I think that Widodo does care about that. I mean, I obviously don't have any personal. It's not like I have a phone call with the guy, but it strikes me that I think that Indonesian nationalism as a whole is taking on, even though we have this kind of vocal, Nurmancho style sort of nationalism that's very anti-gay rights and anti-Western influence and all this sort of stuff, I think there's also another strand of Indonesian nationalism that's more democratic in nature and more about, you know what, you have the right to live however you want to live, and, you know, I'll protect your right to do that. I think that this is actually something that is not foreign to Indonesia. If you look at Indonesian history, Indonesia does have a very old history of supporting sort of democratic intellectuals who, you know, really fought for that to be included in the original Indonesian constitution. So I think that you start to see a little bit of that coming out again now, and I think that's a really good thing.
Yes, definitely. Definitely, I think so. I think I should also, you know, point out, like you talked about, there are certain things that are enshrined in Indonesia, and there are five recognized religions, and Christianity is one of them. I mean, we often talk uh-huh. about Indonesia as being a Muslim-majority country, but, you know, Catholicism and Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, they're all enshrined as official religions, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So yeah, Indonesia is changing. It's got a place to play in the role in the world. It's got, you know, important peace building and non-war fighting functions to promote within the Asia Pacific. It'll be really interesting to see where that country heads. And Nadia, I think we're going to have to check in back with you again on some of those issues. Maybe in a little while.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It'll be. Really great to see what happens here in the next few months.
Nadia, you know, we've had a very thorough discussion about Indonesia, and there's obviously a lot to unpack in terms of history, and we could keep talking about that forever, and I would love to revisit that with you again. For our listeners, with Indonesia being such a complex country and such a rich country, what's the one thing you would like them to consider and to think about Indonesia in the future?
Honestly, I think what people need to take into account when Indonesia appears to be frustrating, appears to not be moving very quickly, is that, A, it's only been a democracy since 1998, and it's only been an independent country since 1945. If you compare it to the sort of the world powers that, it, you know, people expect it to sort of stand up against, or stand up with, I should say, that's a very young country you're talking about. And I think that they've actually done a remarkably good job moving forward through a lot of political upheaval without, you know, too significant bouts of instability. Obviously, there have been really difficult times. But I think that that just needs to be taken into account as people think about Indonesia, and to sort of, you know, realize that you might need to be a little bit more patient, but I think that the dividends are coming for Indonesians and for people who want to work with Indonesia.
Great. Last for today was just to talk a little bit about your other passion, because obviously we're all rather passionate about Indonesia, but you're also passionate about writing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, for listeners who go and visit Nadia's blogs, there's discussion obviously a little bit about Indonesia, but a lot about her writing. You described yourself as a writer of sociopolitical horror, which I thought was fascinating. And I would love you to talk a little bit about that.
Sure. That also has to do with Indonesia, because growing up in Indonesia, you know, I was raised on a steady diet of horror stories. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I get scared very, very easily. I just happen to enjoy being scared, which, you know, I suppose is part of why I've always been drawn to security and conflict studies as well. I also think that fiction is a great way of starting conversations and posing hypotheticals and doing little social experiments that don't hurt anyone. So, you know, I like to say that I write scary stories about the scary world we live in. And yeah, it's a great little side project for me.
That's excellent. I mean, we've seen other people working within security studies to write fiction as well. I mean, there was Ghost Fleet by Peter Singer and August Cole as a means to talking about these kinds of things. Do you discuss Indonesia in any of your horror writings as well?
I do. I usually try to disguise it, but to be honest, I have read reviews that say thinly disguised Indonesia.
Huh?
So
is Indonesia the context? I mean, do you take Indonesia as the geographical backdrop to your writings, or is it more about the themes that you're drawing and you're playing within your writing?
It's both. I think it's been really important to me to sort of bring in this world that I think a lot of Reno readers in the United States don't necessarily have much exposure to. And I also think that Indonesia's got some very interesting social and political themes to explore, as well as some very interesting monsters.
Can you give us a couple of examples of themes that you've explored in your writing with Indonesia?
Sure. I think the most common theme has been basically what we've talked about today, which is how do you break free from the ghosts of the past? And sometimes that's, you know, metaphorical ghosts, and sometimes it's literal ghosts. So that's something that a lot of the times in my Indonesian-based stories, characters are dealing with, you know, running from the past, running from guilt, and then sort of having to stop and face it, essentially, and deal with the baggage that we discussed earlier.
Yeah, most certainly. I mean, I think you've just tapped into something really important as well. I mean, there are many ways you can learn about a country and its history, and a lot of that can be reading analytical stuff and academic work, but also going into popular culture and going into fiction works, going to works of art, poetry, movies is another way to learn. And I don't know about you, but I find it challenging because there aren't as many works about Indonesia either translated in English or available.
Totally.
And they're not projected necessarily to a global audience either. I mean, are there any examples do you think that our listeners could go and pursue to get a feel about Indonesia, or anything that is set in Indonesia that might be fun or important?
I mean, the classic is always going to be the Buru Quartet by Pamuja Anantatur, probably the most famous, greatest Indonesian writer.
Mm-hmm. That was a set of four novels,
incidentally exiled by the Suharto government onto an island called Buru. So that's where he wrote or had the inspiration for his novels. But that's really, I think he really does a great job of capturing sort of the quintessential Indonesian experience, from colonialism to the modern day and struggling with the changes that are involved there. So I would recommend starting there.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, for some of our American listeners, they may be familiar with the films The Raid 1 and The Raid 2.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean that's a little bit more, I mean, that's full-on martial arts, and it's a little bit gory, but I think at least it showcases a little bit about modern Indonesia, or contemporary Indonesia, and Jakarta at that.
It does, but you know what? I mean, to be honest, I mean, I've only seen the rape one. But
it's the better
to be
one.
Honest, is it okay? I didn't recognize Jakarta in that movie. I felt like it was
Jakarta is more in a film too. My bad.
Yeah, I felt like it was some other sort of more Eastern Asian capital. But on the other hand, you know, when I was watching it, I was like, this is the struggle of Indonesian, like, democratic activists who are trying to climb the tower of, like, the state and, like, state control and fascism and having to beat back all these people that are being controlled by this, you know, the guy who's at the very top of the tower. I was like, this is actually a great
Pretty
allegory.
Much. No,
I mean,
absolutely.
Even though it's not intended to be that
and
way.
And without giving away any spoilers, I think you're absolutely right. You know, what are they held back by? They're held back by the corrupt cops, the crooked cops.
Exactly. Yeah. It's actually quite interesting from that angle.
All right, there you have it, listeners. There's so much packed into the raid that we didn't uncover before in terms of trying to understand Indonesia. And for the record, amazing martial arts choreography. Don't look too much in the story in terms of the narrative. It's not that deep, but certainly in terms of an allegory for Indonesia, fabuloso. And I think the reason I bring this up is important because on a global setting, when people think Indonesia and they think Indonesian film, if you Google it, a lot of the time what comes back are the two films, The Act of Silence, The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence.
Yeah.
Films about what you alluded to before, like the 1965 anti-communist purges. And I feel sometimes, I don't know how you feel about this, that it's a shame that that would be the first thing that people would learn about Indonesia, even though it's an important part of its history.
I do think that as well. To be honest, one of the things that I think is one of the greatest shames is that both those movies, as well as the Raid movies, were made by non-Indonesians.
True.
And the fact that then people are like, oh, look at this great Indonesian movie. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like this isn't really even Indonesian. I mean, not really. I think in some ways, especially with the Act of Killing and The Look of Silence, I think there's a little bit of a tendency to maybe say, to maybe leave people with the impression that Indonesians are not working on that issue being the 1965 anti-communist killings, that I think is erroneous. I think that this is something that Indonesia, you know, recently have been struggling very much with. And I think that sometimes when that's all that Western audiences see, they think, you know, Indonesia is this crazy country, you know, that apparently doesn't care about this enormous genocide that happened. And I don't think that's actually true.
No,
I think it's just been a really sort of slow, difficult process, you know, walking uphill. But I think that perception's unfair. And I think sometimes that's what people are left with. So my two cents on that one.
That's interesting. It's almost sort of resonates with the theme you mentioned earlier, that there are things that Indonesia wants to deal with when it's ready.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're right. There have been a series of human rights commissions and other things that have been pursued in Indonesia. And I think even this week, Human Rights Watch, there was another big conference about the 1965 killings, and they've asked the United States to open up some of its archives. So, you know, this is ongoing. And just before, I mean, I would actually love to leave the listeners with one film recommendation that's an Indonesian film made by Indonesians in Indonesia, so turn on your subtitles, people. And it's called, in English, Rainbow Warriors. And it's a beautiful little film set off an island, Belitung, about a little school sort of struggling to make it work. I don't know, Nadia, if you've seen that one. But
I have not, but I've heard great things about it.
Yeah, Laksa Pelangi, great film. So that's one tip for our listeners. If you're going to love watching Indonesian films, mix it up a little. But film, great medium to get to know the country as well. And Nadia, a last question for today. you know, through all of your work and through all of your life, I want to ask who inspires you and why?
Man, I'm not sure, you know, what kind of answers you usually get on this, but, you know, my dad, honestly, he was a political scientist in Indonesia who fought very hard for democracy, you know, frankly. The way he wooed my mother was by telling her that he was a real sincere Democrat. And I think that, you know, to sort of expand on that a little bit more, I think that Mohammed Hatta, the first vice president of Indonesia, was a great figure for fighting for individual rights to be included in the Indonesian constitution. We don't know enough about him, I think, as well as his contemporary, Sutan Syahrir, who's also a very important figure in the struggle against the Dutch and another early proponent of Indonesian democracy. So I personally, in my studies, when I ran across those two guys, I thought, you know, this is like a real Indonesian hero right here.
All right. I think you've just encouraged me to go read a little bit more about those two figures as well. And your dad was also a political scientist and has written a lot about Indonesia's struggle for democracy too, right?
Yeah, he was a political economist. So a lot of what he believed was that, you know, there was an importance of empowering the middle class to encourage them to basically fight for Indonesian democracy, fight for, you know, the people of Indonesia. He was a co-founder of the Marxist Club at the University of Indonesia. And he was, you know, eventually definitely marginalized for this, as you can imagine, under the Suharto regime.
Sure.
But, you know, one of the most gratifying things for me is in going back to Indonesia, sometimes I'll tell people, like, who my father was, and they'll actually say, oh, yeah, that guy, you know, like, he really inspired me, or, like, I took a class with him, and that's been a really gratifying experience, just to know that he impacted people's lives and shaped political thinking, you know, in a small way.
That's wonderful. And there's so much about Indonesia's politics and history left for us to explore. Nadia, we're going to have to leave a little bit of that to another podcast, because today's has been jam-packed full of things to take away. Thanks so much for making time.
Thank you for inviting me. This was great.
And to all our listeners, I strongly encourage you to go and follow up with some of Nadia's writings. You can find her blog at Nadia Bulkin, that's nadibulkin.wordpress.com. It'll also be on the blurb in the SimSec website. And you can follow her on Twitter at Nadia Bulkin. And to all our listeners, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and catch all of our great articles at sipset.org. Thanks very much for joining us, and we hope you come again soon. Bye!